So welcome back to the NeuroCore podcast show, where we will explore the use of qualitative research methods in neurosurgery. Today, I am delighted to welcome Professor Janet Seeley from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Very warm welcome to you today. Thank you for joining us. So Professor Seeley is a professor of anthropology and health and has a PhD from the University of Cambridge in social anthropology. She's been actively engaged in research in the social aspects of health, particularly HIV and AIDS, since the 1980s, and has undertaken extended periods of research in Kenya, Uganda, Zambia, India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Papua New Guinea. Today, we'll be talking about Janet's qualitative work and a paper she co-authored about how qualitative research can contribute to clinical trials. Thank you so much for being with us today. Would you just like to do a short introduction to yourself and also the paper that we're going to talk about today?
I don't think there's much more to introduce myself about, but in terms of the paper, so a colleague and I, Carol Camlin from the University of California, San Francisco, and I wrote the paper really to underline that there was a useful role. There was actually an equal role for social scientists being involved in clinical trials. And we were thinking, particularly at that point, it's 2018, the paper was published, we were thinking particularly around HIV trials of antiretroviral therapy, the changing guidelines. And one of the things we were saying is that actually sometimes you get people using qualitative research methods, if you like, to set the scene, to get the background information for a clinical trial. But we argue in that paper, and we use examples to show how social science can be useful at all stages of a trial. And we also make the point that actually it's sort of not an add-on, that if social scientists are members of the clinical trial team, then you get a more holistic view of the topic you're looking at. So that's what the paper's about.
Great. So we're really looking at some mixed methods research, and that's where certainly in medicine we're seeing a lot more kind of interest in combining quality or adding qualitative to clinical trials. So do you want to talk a little bit about the studies in the paper that you talk about and why specifically in those trials you felt it was necessary to include qualitative methods?
I think I might not talk particularly about, I mean, there was one particular trial that we talk about there, and part of that was how the trial was, in a way, it had added the social science in, so it was, if you like, a little bit of an add-on. Mm-hmm. I think it's let me talk about a more recent trial, one that's Ooh. Ongoing at the moment, because in that trial, which is an HIV vaccine trial, the social science is actually integral to the trial design. And I think one of the interesting things about doing that is that at the beginning of the trial, there was the opportunity, if you like, to use some rapid ethnographic approaches to just get some sense of the setting of the clinics involved in the trial, to understand more about the populations who were going to be involved in the trial. The trial has what's called a registration cohort. That was a cohort that was set up to see how successful we would be in recruiting participants for the trial and to get some idea of HIV incidence in those populations. So social scientists were involved in that, and we were able to do interviews with a sample of people within the registration cohort to get some idea of their opinion and what they were joining, why they were joining, and also their approach to HIV prevention, which was helpful in setting the scene. And as the trial is going on, we have ongoing interviews, three interviews with people in the trial, which is giving information on not only their view of being in a vaccine trial, where actually, you know, there is a a chance that they are not going to be protected, because obviously that's why the vaccine is being tested. But also they get the opportunity to take the pill, the what's called PrEP, PrEP prevention of HIV, that ethically, to ensure people are protected, they're offered PrEP. But we get some idea also of people's attitudes to taking a daily pill, a pill that looks very much like the treatment for HIV. And I think an important part of that is not just these interviews, we're also having staff debriefs. And these are hugely useful to the trial, because it gives a space for people, nurses, counsellors, others who are involved in the trial, to chat about their experience of the trial. They get a space in which to raise some concerns, which can, with their permission, be fed back to principal investigators and others. But it also gives some idea of how they are viewing what is going on in the trial. And I think that's particularly important because one of the things we've learnt from previous work is that actually, if you have a nurse in a clinical trial, and I'm not talking specifically about this one, I'm talking about others now. If you have a nurse in the clinical trial, her concern about recruiting participants to the trial to meet the target that she has may mean that she is very preoccupied with the information and consent process, and be very concerned about what she's actually saying, which will be very different view from perhaps the study clinician who is overseeing it, and certainly the PI. So the nurse isn't necessarily seeing the whole of the trial, or necessarily understanding quite all of the details about why particular people are responding in a particular way to the recruitment, because she's worried about the numbers. And that pressure on people, I think, is very helpful to understand in trials, because it can become a very uncomfortable competition, which actually is detrimental, I think, to the well-being of those involved, if they feel that they are not meeting the standards, whereas the PI may not see it like that at all, and may actually not realise that people are feeling so much pressure to recruit. So those are the sorts of areas where we can make a contribution. And that's touched on in the paper.
That's so fascinating. I think there's one way of seeing, you know, clinical trials that you very kind of reductionist, positivist. We do that. We design a trial to test this A or B. We'll give it to two groups of people, and then we'll see if it works or not. And that's one kind of way of seeing science, isn't it? Whereas actually what you're saying is there's a huge kind of socially constructed environment around that trial. And if we don't understand all of the component pieces which are going on, from the participants and their motivation to join, their motivation to adhere, the motivation to, to continue with the trial, to the motivations and attitudes of the research staff. If you don't understand all of those contextual bits of information around the trial, the answer that you get within the trial, be it yes or no, actually that's you don't understand the why. And you do say this in the paper itself, actually all that qualitative data is helping you to explain your trial results, because lots of trials don't work, they don't work as expected, and this qualitative insight is the helps you to interpret the end answer and the end result of your study.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think one of those things is actually sometimes you get clinically a positive outcome, which actually may be more nuanced. So we had a trial where there was a positive outcome. It looked as if the treatment regimen worked very well. But actually, when you talked to those who were taking part, these were adolescents, they said, look, we're really worried about this, because if our friends who are on similar treatment to us know that you can have weekends off in this case, then they might take longer off, and then the drugs will stop working, and then and then and then. And so all of these worries came from, what does this, we've contributed to this result, we know everybody thinks the result is positive, but we're worried. And so being aware of that anxiety, and actually it can then result in a further phase of working out how to do something more safely. I think that's a critical area. And I think the other thing is that this bigger picture, and I take the example now of a PhD student who's finished, David Lawrence, who very successfully finished his PhD at the end of last year, who worked on cryptococcal meningitis in Africa. He's a clinician. He was the clinician on a trial, but he's trained in medical anthropology. And his PhD was really trying to look at the experience of people being in the trial. Now, cryptococcal meningitis for people living with HIV is invariably fatal if not carefully treated. So if you are going into hospital because of that, you are not in a good place at all. And he was able to look at this, because so much is written about people being in trials and having what are called, you know, a therapeutic misconception, the idea that it's actually a way to get treatment. Actually, what he has shown through his work is this is a very valid therapeutic expectation. People know that being in this trial gives them a chance of being alive. And so just trying to also look at the experience of participants as people who have very good reasons often, and they're not necessarily naive about what's going on at all. They may not understand the trial in the same way you do. They may understand it very, very well, as we found in this trial. Yes, this is a chance to live. And I think those sorts of things, you can easily not be taken into account. And I think that area of why people participate in trials is really important to also understand how they receive the result of the trial. So, and all of those things, I think social scientists can contribute to.
And that latter point about why people participate, another one of the trials you talk about in the paper was recruiting an uneven distribution of men and women. And part of the qualitative data was trying to understand why it was more women were presenting for participation than men. And then that led to a whole series of steps or new considerations about targeting male spaces and, you know, more kind of targeted recruitment of men for the trial, which you wouldn't probably have understood had you not had that qualitative insight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's the understanding why particular groups take part in something. You know, you can have another trial that's actually, it's recruiting women, right? But it may actually be trying to recruit women at particularly high risk for HIV infection, but actually the ones who come forward are not in that category. And that's partly because, you know, it's not necessarily that the ones who are at the greatest risk of HIV infection are reluctant to take part. They're busy, they're traveling. All of those things you can understand by spending a little bit more time understanding the people who are, if you like, being recruited into a trial.
And so there's a place for qualitative research in the design of a study. You talk about this that in-depth work before you've really decided on what your trial will look like. Now, what's the difference, do you think, between good community engagement and involvement, for example, or in the UK we'd call that PPI, what's the difference between that and maybe qualitative, like a separate study that's qualitative? Because some people get those things mixed up.
Yeah, they do get it mixed up, and I get very frustrated when people say, oh, well, you're just doing community engagement. I think that there has to be a very clear distinction, because good community engagement is essential, but that community engagement is not going to be collecting data rigorously, not going to be able to follow through and document things in a way which allows you to look at the progression of the data, if you like. In community engagement, sometimes you do get transcripts from that or interesting meetings, but that's not the primary purpose. And indeed, the people involved in the community engagement shouldn't be expected to be trying to record things or document interviews and things like that. That generally is not their skill set. I am concerned where we do find situations where you're getting a group who haven't had social scientists involved in a clinical trial. They're getting on board thinking this is a good idea, and who do they get to collect the interview data? It's the poor community engagement people. And that then puts a burden on them to try and collect the data. The skill sets are different. They both need to be able to cultivate good rapport, et cetera, et cetera. But I think there is certainly a place for both. They're not merging them puts a big burden on whoever is being merged, if you like.
Good. I'm glad you said that because I agree. And there is some uncomfortable blurring of the lines between these two. So that's really helpful. So just thinking a bit more about kind of qualitative research in medicine, I've certainly seen an increase in interest, and I'm in neurosurgery. I mean, it's a sub-discipline where I would say qualitative research hasn't really found a foothold yet, but it is, you know, interest is increasing. Do you find the same in your experience, that there is more acceptance of qualitative research now than there used to be, and why do you think that might be the case?
Yes, I do, but I think it's in particular areas, and one area where things are slow to change is in drug trials. And I think that, you know, some pharma companies who sponsor drug trials don't feel that somehow involving something that, you know, is qualitative interviews in that way would affect the integrity of the trials. So but Gilead is one, GSK, another, where there are trials where they actively are asking for social science to be involved now. And I think that is because people are realizing if we want to know why we're getting the outcome that we're getting, then it's helpful to have more information. It's very much based on understanding people's response to a product, to the outcome of a trial. So, for example, you had what is now a very famous trial of a vaginal ring for HIV prevention that was trialed in parts of Africa. It didn't work among young women, and it worked among some older women. What was going on? Well, some of the women were actually taking it out before sex because they were worried about the men feeling it. There were lots of things going on which came out in the in-depth interviews and then could be explored further. But actually, without that, it was there was a lot of excitement over the fact the product overall worked with women, but there was a particular groups it didn't, and that understanding came from having the mixed methods, the ability to say actually these people aren't really using the ring as we thought.
That's really interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned kind of big pharma. I review quite a lot of studies, and where I see qualitative research more commonly included, kind of more regularly. And it's interesting in your paper you refer to a review that looked at, I think, every fifth clinical trial and whether they include qualitative. And actually, I was quite surprised at how high the number was of people that were including qualitative research. In my experience, anecdotal maybe, the qualitative methods are quite more commonly reported in feasibility trials. So when they're trying to work out whether something might acceptability of interventions and those sorts of things. But then when it goes to full trial, the qualitative work isn't there. So it's, I mean, have you noticed that? Is that your experience?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the idea of having exploratory work is very acceptable when you're looking at the feasibility, which population, will they accept it, those sorts of questions. But there is this feeling that when you get to the full-blown trial, you've got your different arms, you know, someone's taken the product, placebo, blah blah blah, there's a feeling there's a clean outcome there. And that actually you don't really necessarily need to spend too much time trying to find out what's going on, because it'll either work or it won't. Yes, it may work or it won't, but the experience of the trial can tell you something about what is going on. You know, we've got, for example, the PrEP trials. If you've got this is the prevention of HIV infection trials, you've got different sizes of pills, those sorts of things. You know, people swap them, people cut them up, people do all sorts of things with the product that's being trialed. If you don't know that, you won't know necessarily some of the things that are behind your result. Your drug may work, which is great, but actually it may not be working quite as you thought it was if you don't know the bit more of the story behind it.
And it's the same for choice of outcome measures. Quite often, the outcome measures that we might determine as researchers are important to a population, but actually whether they're clinically important to a participant, you know, we quite often measure the wrong things or things that don't actually contribute significant to quality of life, for example. So having that discussion with people about what is actually meaningful in a trial is a really valuable addition, I think.
Yes, no, it is. And I think I come back to the example of the cryptococcal meningitis. There, you know, that was a drug trial. You know, did this new combination of drugs make a difference to whether people lived or not? Because people were coming in not necessarily conscious, it was, you know, loved ones who were then consenting for them to be in a trial. And that was, you know, they were basically saying, we trust you that this is a good chance that this will work. And it was understanding it's an enormous, also understand the enormous expectation that's on the clinical staff. You know, you're the physician, the overseeing physician on a drug trial like that. You know, it can make you feel great to be seen to be so powerful, but it's huge, huge burden to bear if something doesn't work out. And I think understanding that from the clinic side as well can help to understand the conduct of the trial. So I think there, you know, we often focus on the trial participants, but I think for me, the trial participants are all the staff as well. And I think getting there, take their understanding is critical, because it gives some idea of not necessarily when things go wrong, but understanding more the effort that goes in when things go right, because standard of care generally is not the same as we know, and that understanding can be there but not necessarily the attention and the particular pressure for a drug to work that a clinician or a nurse may be feeling.
So one of the things that I loved in your paper and wanted to talk about was your recommendation for qualitative findings to be published alongside the quantitative data, perhaps in a separate paper but in the same journal. So what do you think are the barriers to this at the moment, and what needs to happen to overcome these?
There is still an extraordinary sort of disdain by some journals about qualitative data, as if it's sort of it's anecdotal and there's also I find it very amusing with inverted commas with clinical colleagues who find a paper over 3,000 words too long.
Yes.
So it's this this sense that actually social scientists write differently. We're often accused of using jargon, terms that people don't understand. Whereas, of course, if you read, as I do, many clinical papers, I understand what a B cell is and a T cell and all of these things. I don't mind. That's part of the paper, but I don't feel that same acceptance is necessarily there for social scientists to, and of course, some social scientists do befuddle us with unnecessary jargon, but to be able to have the same respect for the two is quite critical. We had a very, and I cite this in the paper, very unfortunate situation where we did submit two papers together, what was called the main findings and also then the quality findings to the journal. One, you can guess which, was accepted, the other was rejected, and we only managed to get that published more than a year later in another journal. And actually, that those findings were critical to understanding the findings in what was called the main paper. It is a problem, I think, also that because of space constraints, this happens even with the best colleagues, that you'll find that the social science isn't described particularly well or in any detail in the methods, and there's very little in terms of the results. And there is, I think, a feeling that actually we're reporting on the main trial. That's an ancillary study, you know. And so I think these dynamics, we've got quite a lot to overcome, but a lot rests on the journals. If the journal editors of the things that people love to publish in, whether it's New England Journal of Medicine or the Lancet or the BMJ, you know, that they their openness to understanding the value of having everything together in a volume, I think is quite critical.
And you're right. I mean, we're doing a scoping review at the moment, and I'm looking at, you know, you talk about the bits that are squeezed out in terms of, you know, the word counts. And I'm commonly seeing, first of all, that the bit that gets squeezed out, it seems to be most, is the analytical work. And that's where the magic happens. You know, that's the bit that we need to see. And it feels like we wouldn't, in a quantitative paper, we wouldn't stand for somebody just saying, I did an inferential statistic and leaving it at that. You know, you have to report which statistic you used and how it was and how many degrees of freedom and things like that. So that's convention in a quantitative paper. But it seems OK for a qualitative paper to just say, we did a content analysis,
I know,
or a thematic analysis, and nothing else about the work that was involved in producing the themes at the end of it. And then the other bit that kind of really gets me at the moment is making me kind of have little private rants in my studies, that when all of the data's just stuck in tables.
Yes.
And they do that for word count. But, you know, when you're reading qualitative work, you end up losing all the context and the richness that's informed the work, because it's just all stuck in tables as if it's superfluous. That data is superfluous to the findings. So
I'm afraid if I review a paper where people have put the quotes into a table, that gets pointed out and invariably. I asked them to change it, because I think it's also like people feeling that just putting a quote there is enough. It illustrates without actually providing any analytical narrative around that quote or paraphrasing some of the things that provide the context. A lot of this, I know, is coming from people perhaps who are using things like Invivo and that will extract, you know, sections, you know, according to themes, and you'll get chunks from different interviews, putting them into the paper like that is understandable. But that's one of my problems with using these electronic methods without actually, not necessarily you don't use them, but to actually be reading the whole interview, be reading the whole transcript to get that sense of the how the content all fits together is essential. So I think you can see where this approach to writing is coming from, and part of it, as you say, is about word count. But I think it's detrimental to the integrity of the data, and you do get the tendency where the quotes are being used like as if they're photographs, as opposed to anything which is integral to the text.
That's a lovely metaphor, actually. So there's a particular quote I wanted to read out from the paper that I just really liked. And it's and you say, in complex trials, interventions are often not implemented as planned. Secular trends affect outcomes, and outcomes and their generalizability cannot be interpreted intelligibly without an in-depth understanding of context. So why do you think that in understanding this in-depth context of communities is so valuable broadly, but perhaps more specifically in low resource settings?
Well, I think let me take the example of the Pop Art trial, which was a very large HIV treatment trial in South Africa and Zambia. And we've actually published a paper since this one, which is looking at the importance of context. It's called The Importance of Place. And one of the things I think with that trial that you get when you're choosing study communities, and this is general practice, it's not the trial did something that is generally done when you're trying to get a randomized control trial up and running. Choosing communities, and these communities were urban communities, 12 in Zambia, 9 in South Africa, so 21 very large communities, which the trial was to be implemented in. So those communities were randomized. Actually, what we did rapid ethnographic research at the beginning, and then the qualitative and other social science, because of course social science isn't just qualitative, was done throughout the trial, and the outcome of the trial was not as was expected initially. The treatment didn't work in quite the way that had been expected. When you actually look at those different communities, and we had the detailed data from throughout the trial looking at changes in the community, you could see some of them had a larger middle class population, some of them there were more people coming and going, lifestyles were different levels of young, old. There were many differences across these communities. And actually, when you look at the trial results, you can begin to look at it. And this is what we do in the PLACE paper, which is published in the journal Trials, was really say, well, actually, if you look at the stability, you look at the migration patterns, these other things, it can help you understand why the results emerged in quite the way they did. And it's, I think we don't, particularly if you're doing a randomized sample and you want your sample to be people who are similar or places that are similar, and and you're looking for a group that you're then able to put an intervention into, and then if you like be able to test the intervention equally across everybody. If you don't have the understanding of some of these things that may be different, you won't necessarily be able to understand the outcome. I think context won't necessarily mean you do things differently. You wouldn't necessarily choose a different sample, but at least you'd have some idea that actually there may be some differences there that help you to understand what's going on. And I think that it's a helpful understanding to have, but it can also be make or break one's understanding of the outcome of a trial.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to talk a little bit about your work in Africa. So a lot of your work is conducted in Africa. Are there any different or unique considerations to implementing qualitative designs in countries like this?
Africa's huge and very varied. I mean, I think that the huge privilege I have is to work with some really fantastic social scientists in Africa at the moment. I'm still working in Uganda and South Africa. I think that there is less difference than people think, because I think that some of the assumptions about what people will talk about in interviews, how to conduct interviews, all of those things. The same respect, the same approach is required wherever you're working. I think that it's very important to, and particularly increasingly perhaps, that the opportunity for social scientists from the country to be leading, so not, you know, not parachuting people in from elsewhere, is critical to good qualitative research. But I think actually working together, you know, providing support to each other is critical too. In terms of differences, I haven't done that much work in UK, but we have, for one of the trials that I report in that paper was in UK as well. I actually don't think there was a huge difference in the way the data were collected or anything like that, actually, because at the end of the day, these were people who were getting a particular treatment, and it didn't matter where they were. Of course, the socioeconomic status and other things may be different, but actually in this day and age of the UK, we've got an awful lot of people who are in similar levels of uncertainty with their livelihoods as people in many other parts of the world now.
So my last kind of question really was about advice for those people considering, so neurosurgeons specifically, if you have any, to considering adding qualitative methods to their next proposal.
I think this won't surprise you, but I think I would want them to actually work closely with a trained social scientist, because I do think that they're one of the problems, and this comes back to the problems of some of the papers that we see coming through, are people who don't have the theoretical background to use the methods that they're using. So sticking in some focus groups or some interviews to collect a bit more data isn't quite the same as thinking about how conceptually to place that approach within your study. So I think, you know, without overburdening the neurosurgeons with social scientists, certainly a conversation and involvement in the planning and conduct of that can be very helpful. And, you know, to also be able to look at the data and to think it through, because, you know, it's if you come to qualitative data analysis with the idea of that in vivo is like Stata, that it's going to churn out the results, then you're going to miss something. So I think that's my key piece of advice. Please talk to us.
Well, that's great advice, I think, and something that everyone would benefit from. So thank you so much for talking to me. I've just thoroughly enjoyed that. It's always nice just to sit and talk about qualitative research, and specifically your examples. So I will make put links to the paper so that people can read that and follow up some of the references that we've talked about today. I think there's a huge amount of room and potential for qualitative research to add to clinical trials, and also as standalone studies. You know, they're just studies that people will want to conduct which aren't clinical trials.
Indeed.
But being brave, talking to social scientists, talk to experts in qualitative methodologies, and you know, there is huge potential for qualitative research to contribute to the evidence base. So thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you.